Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. This is on the occasion of our first in-person retreat in about 2 years. And as you can see, we have various people who have come for it. And I thought I would talk about silence. Because we haven't done retreats in quite some period of time, we had to remind ourselves about the necessity of silence during the retreat and minimum amount of talking. And this can be extraordinarily helpful in our practice. We can even take it up on our own, for that matter, for periods of time when we're on our own or at home. What it does is brings into focus how our minds are constantly churning, and how often we are moving from our sitting place through trying to communicate. And the importance in a retreat or when practicing silence to examine one's mind and watch how the mind works. I've mentioned before about my first experience of this when I became a postulant to Shasta Abbey in May of 1978. The postulants got up half an hour early to sweep the cloister. So that's half an hour before the chief junior rang his bell. And it was my first day as a postulant. And so I wore robes and had my hair clipped and was standing there in the cloister with the broom. And I remember the strong double feeling of being completely exposed to my own koan and to my own self, and also how it was impossible to escape oneself at that particular period of time. So that, given that there were no other distractions, the contents of my own mind came up and presented themselves rather forcefully. And that in connection with having to do something, that is, sweeping the cloister, it became even stronger. Now, I've talked a lot over the years about the whole business of training being connected to everyday life. And I've also said from time to time about the purpose of training is not to become extraordinary, but to become ordinary. And we've had some questions regarding that. What I mean is that when people undertake spiritual practice of any sort and Buddhist training of any sort, it's not uncommon for them to live in a type of mythical future, which they can't really imagine, where all their problems will be solved and everything will be hunky-dory. It isn't that there are no results of training. Certainly the most joyous times in my life have been in connection with training. And also the most profound and deep relations relationships that I've had with other people have been within this context of training. But the way in was to look at the most ordinary aspects of my daily life. And even though various meditative states occurred for me, I still had to come back to the ordinary contents of my mind within the context of daily life. Various mental states arise in meditation, but they are not the same thing as meditation itself. Various enlightening experiences can occur as well, but they are not enlightenment itself. To understand what the Buddha meant by not self and what Dogen meant by dropping off body and mind, it is really necessary to practice within the context of our ordinary daily lives. And generally speaking, most deep experiences that occur not so much in the context of the meditation hall, but in the context of daily life. My first job at Shasta Abbey, when I went there, as a layperson actually in 76, was working in the goat department. We had a goat herd and we milked the goats. What would one sometimes hear from people when they were put in that department is how far away this type of work was from what monks should be doing, or how it was more important to be doing practice in a more formal way. Because with the goats, we had to milk them morning and evening, and they had to be fed. And you couldn't put it off. You know, you can't say when you're going to milk goats in the afternoon, in the evening, well, I'll put it off until tomorrow morning. You just can't do that. I gather, although I've never had any children, I gather that it's quite similar having children. Or, for that matter, a job in the world. You have to get up and be at the place at the time that your work starts. And all of this serves to concentrate the mind. But too many people, when they think of training, long for it not to be ordinary daily life. And what does the scripture say? Compounding delusion later on by following ideals. So often we don't want to be where we are spiritually. We want to be calmer. We want to be without anger or desire or whatever, at least for that moment. We want to have everything clear. We want not to be afraid. And the training is done not separating oneself from these things. Training is not done, how do I put it, when we get to the point of being ideal people. It's done where we are at any given moment or time. The Buddha, when he was quite old, there's a story of a monk who was blind, and he was sewing his robe. And because he couldn't see to thread the needle, he called out to the assembly and said, "Is there any monk who wishes to make merit by helping me to thread this needle?" And it was Shakyamuni who got up and went over to help him thread the needle. Shakyamuni also talked about, as he got older, how his back would ache. And that was because when he was younger, he practiced extreme ascetic practices. And as a result of that, he had somewhat bad health in the stomach area and also bad back. So, and also an important thing that I always thought of, people who visited the Sangha could not generally distinguish Shakyamuni from the other monks. There is even a passage where somebody says, "That's the Buddha standing there. He's a little bit shorter than whoever it was, Nanda or whoever." So this was something that all took place within the context of ordinary daily life and ordinary problems. Shakyamuni experienced the death of his, his secondary mother, because his mother died just shortly after he was born, so he didn't really know her at all. But he experienced things like the entire destruction of his people, who were wiped out in a massacre, the Shakyas. Now, if you read the story, the Shakyas kind of provoked the whole thing, but still. And the Buddha went and sat when he knew this king was going to come and attack the Shakyas. He sat in the road underneath a withered tree. And when the king came up to him, the Buddha remarked about how if all the Shakyas were killed, the Buddha would feel like he was without shelter. And after a while, the king just went ahead and attacked the Shakyas and killed most of them. So it is not that the Buddha's life was without tragedy or difficulty. In Buddhist countries, when people use a set of prayer beads or a rosary, it's very common for people to recite, "Life is uncertain, death is certain," as a mantra as they turn the beads. The interesting thing about this is pretty much totally different from what we are told in the West to do for the sake of mental health, or whatever you want to call it. Because sometimes what people mean by mental health is, how do I successfully ignore reality? That might be a bit too harsh, but some of you would have seen that little video of the medieval peasant goes to therapy that I sent around. The reason I thought that was so good is because the person had been told to practice these various things, like more communication with their mother, taking responsibility for their lives, objectively looking at the weak, and was repeating back, in a sense, psychobabble. And it wasn't not doing them the least bit of good, because it was not based upon the reality of people's lives. So I thought it was very, very telling. One of the things that I've always tried to be extremely careful of in teaching is what's sometimes called Buddhism light, or dumbing down the teaching. Because I know that unless one really applies oneself to training, the results will not come. And platitudes and so-called quotes from the Buddha, it was rather depressing. I looked up, I was going to talk about silence, and so I looked up the Google Buddha quotes on silence. Page after page of quotes that have nothing to do with the Buddha at all. As some of you would have heard, there's a website called Fake Buddha Quotes, in which you can check if you come across a quote that says it's something the Buddha said, when usually, under those circumstances, it's Norman Vincent Peale, Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, what's that Hubbard guy?
L. Ron Hubbard.
L. Ron Hubbard. All sorts of things except what the Buddha taught. And there was an example that I talked about, which I'm not going to go into detail, but there was an example quite recently, actually, about a year ago or so, where which has caused caused a huge deal. There was a book published that was advertised. It was published by a major publisher, Shambhala, actually. Ought to have known better. A book published as a translation of early Buddhist scriptures, specifically the verses of the female elder monks. I was sent a copy. And I sort of did a double take when I read it. And as I say, it presented itself as a translation. It was presented and used as a translation when it's nothing of the sort. It's a series of more or less erotic poetry done by an American man and put in the mouths of the female elders. And what alarmed me more than anything else later on is the number of people who took to it and made use of it. Eventually, the publisher, there's talk about the publisher withdrawing the book, actually, given that they called it a translation when it isn't at all. And the author of the poems removed all references to rebirth, all references to actual enlightenment, and made the poems all about these women's relationships with their families or their husbands or their emotions. Aside from the fact, of course, as I said, the insertion of erotic elements that one could spot at 10 paces, having been written by a man than a woman. And I would hold that up as a perfect example of Buddhism light and how pervasive it can be, because people get tired of sometimes the monotony of practice without realizing that the arising of the River Master Ji used to talk about this, as did Chogyam Trungpa. He was a lot more brutal about it, is the way he would put things. But that the feelings that arise when one practices are part of the path. They are not necessarily obstacles to the path. Neither is it a question of being without them. The monotony, or if I can put it that way, or boredom of practice is, how do I put it? Is something one needs to approach closer to rather than trying to run away from. Because when we are used to imagining sometimes spiritually spicy food, it's very difficult for us to recognize spiritual food, to stretch the metaphor. There's that saying that the Buddha said that the Dharma has one taste, just as the ocean has one taste, the taste of salt. So the Dharma has one taste, the taste of liberation. And as Dogen says, liberation is to go beyond the distinction between the ordinary and the extraordinary. It is in the very burrowing into those feelings that arise of boredom or dissatisfaction or craving to be distracted, etc., is to actually sit still with them, to go into them, and not to think that there is something wrong because they're arising. I sent around a thing about Mother Ming's tea. You know, the Reverend Master Ji used to quote it all the time, and then I finally succeeded in sending it around, part of a Wikipedia article. Mother Ming, when one dies, is supposed to, according to Chinese sort of mythology, feeds people a broth or a tea that she makes. And the tea helps one to forget one's previous existence so that one can continue on in rebirth. But of course, the thing that it also does is it leaves intact the opinions, views, inclinations. So what we end up with in this lifetime is we have opinions, views, vain imaginings, inclinations, desires that come from the past, but we have forgotten their origin. And because of that, we need to examine very, very carefully what arises in our own minds and sit still with it. I've said many times that was the very essence of Reverend Master Jiu's practice. When she went to Japan, and later on, but when she was training in Sojiji, nothing made sense in Sojiji. You had an entirely different culture, which, as Reverend Master used to say, was like cats and dogs. Dogs growl when they're upset and wag their tails when they're happy. Cats growl, purr when they're happy and wag their tails back and forth when they're upset. And Reverend Master used to say that the Japanese and the British were like the cats and dogs in that regard. She used to say you could never do the right thing. People would say, oh, sit wherever you like. And then you would sit wherever you liked and you'd be sitting in the wrong place. The token out in front of the tokenoma, and everybody would become upset. So, and I think this is obvious from the Wawai Goose, and she may very well have, when she went to the East imagined an ideal training situation because she was very, very much drawn to Japanese culture and admiration for it, even though she had men who had been prisoners of war of the Japanese come to her and beg her not to go to Japan and show her their wounds from being in the concentration camps that the Japanese had throughout Asia. So in that sort of circumstance, there was the necessity of embracing one's life as it was. Partly because she was the only Westerner there, usually, and they weren't going to change everything for her. They finally got a women's bathroom later on when she was there, which was somewhat helpful. And I hope I'm coming across clearly. Do not seek for ideal circumstances. Many people make that mistake when they think of going and living in monasteries. Monasteries concentrate the difficulties. It helps that people try to be silent, so you don't hear their difficulties quite so much. But one of the major problems with, I would call Buddhism light, is seeking ideal circumstances. I remember somebody describing in a film what mindfulness was like. And the person was describing how they had their coffee in their particular cup that they were very fond of in the morning, and that how this was, you know, an experience of mindfulness. I must confess, I immediately thought, weren't they at work? and this was, and I was watching it with a group of Chinese Buddhists who were flabbergasted that anybody would say such a foolish thing. They almost were despairing of the whole of Western Buddhism as a result. They thought, oh my God, this is dreadful. Because mindfulness, of course, can be practiced under all circumstances. And it's not related to, if we think about our own lives, pretty much most of us here are getting to the point where, as the same phrase goes, we shall soon be old if we are not old already. And Shakespeare has that Seven Ages of Man, that rather terrifying poem, if you actually read it, in which he talks about the seven sort of steps of life. And the ending one, he says, what is it? Second childishness, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans sense, sans everything. And yes, of course, we all go along thinking, not dwelling on the fact that we may lose our teeth, our eyes, and everything. I certainly don't dwell on it. But it does kind of creep up on you whenever you... I had a root canal recently. It took me 3 days to recover what would have only been, you know, a short period of time. Mind you, they were wrestling me in the chair and trying to get this thing down to my mouth to take the x-rays, and basically tried 4 times. Anyway, they didn't apologize exactly. They just said, boy, we really gave you a going over, didn't we? and also, our minds and our clarity of minds may not last. And that thought can be scary. Unless you remember that, like before, I remember we'll do like we did before. I remember a crisis that occurred at Shasta. Well, no, it wasn't at Shasta, actually. It was a situation that arose that I had to deal with in British Columbia. Really difficult circumstance where I was, in a sense, being put in a situation of feeling that I was lying, not by the order, but this was by somebody who had talked to me. And I, you know, contacted River Master and got very good, if very difficult, advice, which was to tell the person that this was not a good course of events and to tell them directly. But I wrote her afterwards and I said, what will we do when you're dead? And then I answered my own question. I said, we'll do the same thing we did when you were living. We'll take refuge. We'll do the best we can. We'll try to see where things are. And we'll trust that we can proceed. One of the things that one can learn from being with people who are dying, which is why Buddhist monks in the East consider it such an important thing to do, is because you can see that although it may be difficult, it is doable. Particularly when you are with people who have been meditating. When I was a new monk, I was working with somebody in the animal department, which was basically the chickens and the geese. It was a woman, and I didn't know her at all. She was assigned to that work by the guest department. And she and I were working alongside one another for the afternoon. And afterwards, I went to the guest master and I said, that woman was a nun, wasn't she? And they said, yes, how do you know? Because she carried her inner silence with her. She could work alongside other people, cooperating with them, but not requiring anything from them. Oftentimes, or it can be when one works alongside other people, there can be, particularly in a business or work situation, a type of grabbingness that goes on because people want to be self-justified in reference to other people. They want other people to continuously, affirm them. And this woman, who had been a nun, I think, for, gosh, a long number of years, she didn't do that. You could work alongside of her without the feeling of being pushed or required or anything along those lines. And it was quite pleasant, actually, because we were both able to accomplish a lot more than we would under other circumstances. I would say what she had learned was getting oneself out of the way and being able to put down the task when the task was over. I got a reputation at Shasta in the very early days being able to do this somewhat by accident. We were digging out the foundations of the ceremony hall where the posts go. And I, being tall, for some reason, they thought I would be more able to do it because I could lie down on my and dig out. We were digging them out with tin cans, digging out the post holes, and the post holes would go in. And just as we had completed them all, the architect or whatever came around and said they all had to be moved. And some of the other monks said I was being very calm about it. And I said, well, actually, it was because I was going to be leaving the next day to go up back to Newfoundland. So I wasn't going to worry about whether or not they shifted the post holes. And to a degree, being able to put down something, I've said that before about River Master Jihu's training. River Master could pick up and put down and not run after something. Not run after the past or run towards the future. So it was very interesting training alongside of her, because she also had developed that inner quiet or inner silence. And the way we learn how to develop the inner silence is by learning how to be silent. And how not to seek outside of ourselves for our own self-worth, but rather to find it within ourselves, within our own Buddha natures, because that is where we will actually find true verification, if I can put it that way, of ourselves and our true nature. When we are able to find other people who are training in this way, then we can receive the benefits of training together with them. But as Reverend Master Ji used to say about monks, monks are not pals with one another, because we try very hard not to confirm other people's delusions. And as I heard from somebody once about the practice of a successful marriage or relationship was because the two people were willing to confront one another of their respective delusions. And too many people are trapped in unhappy and I would say unhealthy relations with family members over precisely this issue. I will stop there. Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.